Today's Teisha will be on case 18 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Cliff Record, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 18, Emperor Shakuso asks about the style of the pagoda. The main subject, Emperor Shakuso asked Chu Kokushi, "When you are 100 years old, what shall I do for you?" Kokushi answered, "Make a seamless pagoda for this old monk." Kokushu answered, "Oh, make a seamless pagoda for this old monk." The emperor said, "I should like to ask you, what style is it to be?" Kokushu remained silent for a while, and then he said, "Do you understand?" "No, I do not," said the emperor. "I have a disciple called Tangen," said Kokushi, "who has the Dharma seal transmitted by me. He is well versed in this matter. Please ask him." After Kokushi's death, the emperor sent for Tangen and asked him about it. Tangen said, "South of Sho and north of Tan, in between gold abounds. The ferry boat under the shadowless tree, no holy one, in the emerald palace you see." Setro's verse, "It is difficult to describe. The dragon does not thrive in a placid place. Tier after tier, superbly it casts its shadow. Let it be admired for 1,000 ages. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice today and for sitting so still, so well. People are really in deep samadhi. That's wonderful. And of course, when we all practice together, we encourage each other in so many ways. It's wonderful. So this is a koan that has many different versions. This, of course, like all these koans, goes back to China. And there are complicated and simple versions of this koan. But basically, Chu Kokushi, Kokushi means national teacher, so he's a Zen monk of distinction, is speaking with the emperor. And the emperor says, basically, you know, when you're about to die, what shall I do for you? And Kokushi says, make a seamless pagoda for this old monk. And, you know, as I read this, you probably caught pagoda. Yeah, make a pagoda for me, right? But actually, the key to this whole koan is this idea of seamless. So I should add that a pagoda in this case is not just one of those towers you see in Japanese and Chinese temples. You know, you might not realize this, but if you go to, say, Southeast Asia, if you go to Thailand, or if you go to Sri Lanka, and Tibet even, you see these stupas, right? The stupa form has a round base, and then it has a square centerpiece, and then it has a soaring top, right? It's sort of like a conical top. And each of these represents a different layer of reality. Now, you know, the interesting thing is when you go to China and Japan, you don't see those. They evolved into pagodas, right? Those multi-storied structures we see around Chan and Zen temples. Okay. So there's usually like a big pagoda around the temple. And there are some very famous pagodas in China, especially some really beautiful pagodas. But also, there are little pagodas, and you will see these in Japanese temples, in the graveyard, and also in Chinese Buddhist temples. So there are little stupas, little pagodas, basically, and inside the pagoda often are the relics of the master Okay. So in this case, it's not really about one of those giant, build me a giant multi-story pagoda. It's make me a funeral pagoda, basically. But it has to be seamless. See, that's the thing. And, you know, basically the emperor probably doesn't get it either, but, you know, usually a pagoda would not be seamless. It would be cut from multiple stones laid on top of each other, you know, or it might be made of brick and then plastered. So the Kokushi, the national teacher, is asking something really special. He says, make me a monument, make me a pagoda that has no seams. It's actually just one piece. It's just all one piece. So it would be as though he's saying, a funeral stupa that's carved from a single stone, right? He says this to the emperor, and the emphasis is on single. And the emperor doesn't get it. He said, well, what style? Oh, that sounds good. What style should it be in, right? And he's good-hearted, but he doesn't get it. Chu Kokushi leans over and says, do you understand what I'm asking you for? And the emperor's honest, you know, he's a good guy. He goes, no, I'm not sure I do. I guess I don't. And he says, well, I have a disciple called Tangen, who has, you know, basically had a great awakening experience. He's well-versed. Please ask him. So after Kokushi dies, we've been talking about preparations for Kokushi to die. The emperor sends for Tangen, and Tangen says, south of Sho and north of Tan, in between, gold abounds. The ferry boat under the shadowless tree, no holy one in the Emerald Palace you see. Now this is the heart of the koan, really. It's like, what is he talking about? So now that we see the problem, we can begin to engage with the koan, right? And if you were to sit with this koan, the turning phrase I would give you is seamless, right? Seamless. And seamless means like a seam in your clothing. It means not of two parts, right? Something made of one whole part. Okay. So, you know, today, you know, when meditation is often taught, people will instruct beginners by saying, you know, be in the moment. Be in the moment. And, you know, it is certainly true that a lot of the time we're caught up in thoughts. Are, you know, we're thinking this, we're thinking that, then, you know, we're distracted by something, and then we have another thought, and then we're distracted, or we start getting interested in something, and this is often called the monkey mind, right? This is often called the monkey mind. And I've noticed that, you know, my students are, you know, often in what you could call the monkey mind. They come into the classroom and they're immediately all on their phones, and they're scrolling through emails, or they're looking at one of the other platforms, communications, right? And you can look at these reels or these little short videos, or and you can spend hours. And my students, they don't like to be just in unstructured time, right? So as soon as they come into the classroom, they're all on their phones. I have to say to them, please put your phones away, and that they put them down, and I say, no, please put them away, put them in your bag, and they, with trembling hands, they put them away. And I was just reading something about how addictive all of this is. You know, this is called the attention economy, and what people make money off of is your attention. So the more times you look at one of these platforms, and you look at some of the little videos on them, or so on, or the messages, you know, if it's Reddit or something, the more times you go to that, and this is true for the older ones among us. For Facebook, it's the same thing. The more times you go to Facebook and you look at Reels or you look at somebody's post, you know, the more money they make. So they want you to be addicted to their platform, right? And lots of people just can't not go there. So, you know, there's actually a movement to retrieve your attention. And, you know, there's a theory that when you go online and you scroll like this, and every time you look at a little video or you get a message or you look at a Facebook post, you get a little hit of dopamine. And there are these people now who are, you know, offering like cleanses, dopamine cleanses, where you're just going to be off the internet for a while. And it's very hard, you know, people become so addicted. So, you know, one of the things they do is they make a vow not to go onto Reddit or not to go on to some of these other platforms and to just sort of be aware of the world around them. And lots of people report that they feel better. They say, I feel better, I'm not grasping after, you know, I'm not they all say it's a little hard not to be on my phone because when I'm not on my phone, I feel bored. You know, when I'm just looking around the room, I feel bored. And so everybody's familiar with this. And, you know, when people come to practice meditation, the teacher might say, you know, your problem is that you're doom scrolling or you're on, you know, one of these platforms all the time and you're going from video to this and that and you're not in the moment, right? So not in the moment. And a lot of these people who have these digital detox programs also say, you know, this is about being in the moment. Be in the moment. So meditators, if they come here, I will say, you know, try to watch your breath and just be present in the here and now. Be present in this moment. And this is pretty good advice, right? And if you're driving on the Garden State Parkway and you're supposed to turn off at the 88th exit ramp and you miss it and you head into the wilds of South Jersey, you could say, oh, I just wasn't in the moment, right? So a huge volume of Buddhist literature in America has this idea of being in the moment, be in the moment, only be here now, and so on. You know, basically we reproach ourselves. We'll say, oh, you know, I have to quit, you know, daydreaming. I need to be in the moment. So anyway, I think this is all okay. You know, this is all okay. But actually, it's really not correct, right? If you think about it, if you're reading a poem, are you in the moment or not, right? I mean, in other words, you know, you could say, I wasn't in the moment, I was reading. Or if you're on your phone and you're reading a Facebook post, you can say, oh, are you in the moment or are you not in the moment? See, I hope this is making some sense. Actually, if you're on your Facebook post, you're in the moment. If you go from your Facebook post to your email, you're still in the moment. See. So actually, this idea that we cannot be in the moment really doesn't make any sense, right? You're always here and now, always, even if you're distracted. Even distraction is a kind of being in the moment too. So it sounds like right now I'm just actually setting on fire the whole structure of Buddhist meditation teaching. And that's certainly not my intention. And it's not the intention of this koan, but actually this language of being in the moment is actually rather false. It's really false. You can't not be in the moment, whether you're distracted, whether you're on Facebook, whether you're reading. Every moment of consciousness is a moment of consciousness, see? So to say you've got to be in, quit daydreaming, be in the moment. That's actually not correct. So you know, actually this occurred to people about a couple hundred years into Buddhism. Let me just say that, people began to realize, well, wait, you know, we're always in the moment, so that can't be the problem. And then, you know, early Buddhists began to try to define what are the elements of the moment. So actually there's this huge elaborate discourse in Theravada Buddhism, in early Buddhism, on the nature of the moment. And that they said, you know, the moment has an external dimension and the moment has an internal dimension. And they made a list of the external elements that make up the moment. And they made another list of the internal elements that made up the moment. And they tried to decide what combination of these internal elements and these external elements is liberating. See? So early Buddhists realized that the problem isn't that we're not in the moment, that we're always in the moment. You can't not be in the moment. See? So that's a common way we say mindfulness is about being in the moment, but actually you can't not be in the moment. So these early Buddhists said, well, there must be some moments that are better than other moments, better in terms of a liberation or awakening. So the problem isn't that we're not in the moment. The problem is we're in the wrong kind of moment, see. And this led to this very complicated, early Buddhism is really super complicated, right? And this all these components of the external aspects of the moment and the internal aspects of the moment and so on. But, you know, actually, in the Mahayana, we took a rather different approach, right? So there are some moments, you know, where you're hyper aware, maybe you're self-conscious, you know, and you may be anxious or you may be calm, right? There are other moments where you're not 100% present, right? So sometimes if you're like me and you have to go to a committee meeting, I'm not really like 100% present. I'm like 50% present, just enough so if they ask me a question, I can answer the question. I think my students are sometimes like 30% present, if I'm lucky. So you know, the fact is that there really are different, you know, we are in the moment in different ways from moment to moment. And, you know, sometimes we're hyper-present and sometimes we're half-present. Sometimes our discriminating minds are very active, you know, so like when you're writing, you know, you're writing is in the moment, you know, you're sitting there, you're focused, you're looking for the right word, you're making revisions as you write, you know, you're worried about what you're saying. If you give a lecture, right, it's the same thing. You're present in a certain way. If you go out to dinner, you know, it's different kind of consciousness. You're relaxed, you're having a good time, maybe you're with friends and family, you're enjoying the taste of the chocolate cake you're eating for dessert, something like that. That's also a moment. You're also in the moment just as much as when you're hypervigilant about what you're writing or you're lecturing. All of those are, so there's all these different ways of being in the moment. Right? All these different ways. So the problem is not that we're not present in the moment. The problem is that we're not, that there's all these different ways of being in the moment. So what happens to us, if this is all true, what happens to us when we come to meditate? We sit down on the cushion and, you know, the teacher might say, please don't lose yourself in thought. Please focus on the breath. And you don't lose yourself in thought. After a while, you struggle and you come back to the breath. And after a while, your stress goes away. You feel grounded, you feel safe and connected. See? So if we're always in the moment, What is it about that particular kind of moment? What is it about that particular kind of moment that has these remarkable effects? So it's not that we're not in the moment, it's that when we get into this kind of a moment, it has all these beneficial effects. What is it about that kind of moment that's so beneficial? See, and actually, most American Buddhists don't know. In fact, early Buddhists didn't know. They tried to figure this out. They realized that there sometimes when you meditate, you feel so much better. And they too also said, well, it's because you're in the moment. And then they realized, well, that can't be true. And then they tried to define the different features of the moment. And that really, I would say, got them nowhere. It was only later in Buddhism's development that people began to be aware of what you could call like the unconscious mind. The unconscious mind. There's a conscious mind, which is thinking and having sensation and is aware or not aware of its sensation. But behind that mind, there's another mind. See, there's like this other mind. It's like in front of your eyes, all this stuff is happening. But behind your eyes, there's this other mind, right? It's this other mind. The thing is that when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath and we focus on the breath, you know, what happens is that we begin to become aware of the presence of this other mind. So you know, when you're having dinner with your friends and you're enjoying the cake at the end, you know, your attention is totally on what's happening in your field of consciousness, right? Field of consciousness. When you're writing books, you know, you rarely do anything but, you know, focus on the words coming out of your head onto the page, onto your typing fingers. You know, when you're watching TV, you know, you're totally absorbed in this. But when we sit down on the cushion and we, when we watch the breath and we take away a lot of distracting elements, it's as though from behind our eyes something approaches us, yeah? It's like a dark stranger is beginning to come from behind us, right? And we don't see the dark stranger, but we feel the dark stranger. It's as though, right, I'm looking at the floor in front of me, but it's as though there, like a shadow is arising behind my eyes, right? And when I'm in the presence of that shadow, it changes everything. I hope this is making some sense. Maybe it's not, but I'm trying. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we watch the breath, something really qualitative happens to us, right? And it's not so much in what we're aware of as it's not that. Meditating on the breath is good. You could be meditating on a candle. You could be meditating on a mantra. You could be reciting Om Mani Padme Om, you know. But when the mind is absorbed in these very simple tasks, it's as though the unconscious comes closer to us and becomes activated. And it doesn't have any content, but we feel different. We feel different. If you practice meditation for just a little while, if you start sitting regularly and you are watching your breath and you don't follow your discriminating mind and you don't chase your thoughts or lose yourself in mental loops, if you keep coming back to the breath, one day you sit down on the cushion and you feel like $1 million. You're just gonna feel, oh, I feel so good. And if somebody said, why do you feel good? You won't be able to explain it probably, right? And you'll be like the emperor in this story, you know. But, you know, one of the things that when people do get interested in meditation and persist, it's because they feel differently when they meditate. This might be obvious, but why do you feel differently? What is it about your experience on the cushion that's different? See? And you know, you're always watching the breath, but sometimes when you're watching the breath, it's as though, I would say it's like you start, it's like a stranger, a big shadow is coming up behind your eyes, or it's like suddenly you realize you're immersed in warm water, right? It's like suddenly it's like you realize you're floating in warm water, in like this warm water, right? It's like you're floating on something, right? You're floating, or like there's a shadow behind you that's not menacing. It's like this gentle, comforting presence. It's like presence, you could also say. If you said presence of what, you wouldn't be able to say, see? But there's a qualitative difference when we start meditating regularly, and it's different from most other moments that we have, right? It's different from when we're writing or when we're cleaning the dishes or watching a television show. All of those are so outward focused, right? So outward focused that we're not aware that there's this unconscious mind operating or present right behind our conscious mind. It's as though we look out at the world and behind our eyes there's something we never notice unless we meditate. And we don't notice it as a thing. We just begin to become intimate with this water that's supporting us, or this shadow that's enclosing us, right? And it feels so beautiful, right? You know, sometimes you'll come in and you'll sit down on the cushion and you'll get nowhere. But you know, eventually, you know, you come in on the cushion and you begin to feel so grounded and safe. And it's like somebody's got her arms around you. But you know, when you look around, it's the same room, it's the same people, it's the same. So what's the difference? And the difference is that, you know, behind your eyes, so to speak, your unconscious mind is activating and it's drawing closer to you. Yes, it's drawing closer to you. And as it draws closer to you, you feel safe and secure and grounded and centered and connected. And, you know, people go their whole lives and they're never aware of this presence behind their eyes, so to speak. And in Zen, we call this your big mind, right? You have a little mind, which is the thinking mind that looks out through your eyes at the world. But behind that thinking mind, there's this other mind. And when you simplify the tasks of the thinking mind and you make them repetitive and so on, and you put the body in the proper position and you coordinate breathing with attention, right? The body, mind, unity. All of those things are conducive to the drawing close or the summoning up of your unconscious mind. So it's like the conscious mind is here and now this great being is drawing closer to you. And when the two come together, see, that's when you feel wonderful. That's when you feel wonderful. When you get off the cushion, you might not appreciate what's happened, you know. And it's a mysterious process for a long time. The early Buddhists didn't figure this out. They thought there's something about the moment. If we could only figure out the moment. They were only looking at moments of consciousness. They didn't know about the unconscious. But it's when the conscious mind and the unconscious mind come together, when the unconscious mind comes together with the conscious mind, that we feel grounded and safe, see, and wonderful. So actually, one way to understand meditation practice is that we're learning how to unify these two minds, which are ordinarily not unified at all, and often working at cross purposes, especially in our time, because we devote so much energy to information. We're so estranged from the unconscious mind, right? We're so estranged from this water that we float on, or this strange shadow behind us that supports us, right? Most people go through their whole lives unaware of this. And if you go to a therapist, right, and I'm a big champion of therapy. I think I myself have gone through therapy. I have nothing but wonderful things to say about therapy. But, you know, often therapy understands the unconscious mind in a very shallow way, right? It's your personal unconscious. So I've talked about this before, but, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who doesn't do Zen and who is a psychotherapist, and I was saying, well, that's just your personal unconscious. And she laughed and said, well, what other unconscious is there? It's like, well, there's the giant behind your eyes, this giant shadow behind your eyes that when it draws closer, you feel totally safe and connected to the world. See? So actually, even like Freudians have a very shallow understanding of the unconscious mind. You know, they mostly do focus on some very superficial aspects of the unconscious, and there's nothing wrong with therapy. But, you know, we in Zen believe in what the Shinshin Ming calls the unified mind in accord with the way. And the unified mind is not just unified with the world in front of us, right? The unified mind is the two parts of our awareness come together, right? Normally, we're cut off from our big mind, and we feel anxious, fearful, etc. But when the two parts are operating in harmony, we feel completely at ease in the world, and confident, and even fearless, right? Those moments have happened to all of us, or you probably wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have gotten up this morning, right? So, basically, Zen is about activating the big mind, and then gradually harmonizing the big mind with the small mind, right? And all of our practice is really about learning, first discovering the big mind, and then learning how to have a relationship with the big mind. And as I say, most people have no concept of this. You know, they understand the unconscious, if they think about it at all, as like, a personal unconscious, right? So you, in therapy, you might realize that you are jealous of your brother or something like that, and that's fine. That's an achievement. But this is much deeper. This is like the source of all awareness, right? This big mind. And first we have to discover it, right? First we discover it. And, you know, one way to discover it is just to start practicing meditation, and you begin to feel grounded and safe and so on. But you could understand all of koan practice as basically undoing the obstacles that prevent us from becoming aware of or being intimate with our big mind. So, all koans have this character of bringing to our attention the barriers we have constructed between our small selves, our ordinary consciousness, and our big mind. And, you know, what koans do is gradually place us in a contradiction that is insoluble. So, you know, if you look at all these koans, you know, basically, they all involve leading you towards some kind of a contradiction that you can't resolve, no matter how intelligent you are or diligent you are. The contradiction is insoluble. So in this case, you know, the emperor is so enamored with Chu, he realizes that Chu is a deeply awakened person, and he says, you know, when you're approaching your death, what would you like? What kind of a monument would you like, right? And Kokushi answers, make a seamless pagoda of the old monk. And the emperor is this wonderful man, right, who is very good-hearted and so on, but he's completely unaware of the big mind. So he only sees what is in front of his eyes, and he has never had an intimate encounter with the stranger, the shadow, the great being behind his eyes. And so when Kokushi says seamless, he doesn't get it at all. You know, he says, well, what style? You know, he's still, okay. So he's not even able to experience contradiction, right? Because he's so clueless. But so many of these contradictions, so many of these koans involve contradiction. So basically, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. Or Basso's, it's neither mind nor Buddha. You know, in one koan, Basso says, it's not mind, it's Buddha. In another koan, he says, neither mind nor Buddha. So the tactic of the koan is to confront us with some kind of an insoluble contradiction. And of course, in our own lives, sometimes, you know, we have insoluble contradictions that make us aware of the big mind. So, you know, if you have somebody you love who is suffering, right? Somebody you love who's suffering, or even somebody you love has recently passed away, right? You know, that we want to explain that somehow to ourselves, and you know, we come up with little stories. We might say, well, you know, so-and-so passed away, now she's out of pain, or now he's in a better place, but there's really no way to make that better or tell that story in a way that's going to make the facts acceptable to us. And, you know, sometimes people are in a state of acute grief for a long time, or upset or outraged, and then suddenly they find peace, right? They find peace. People say, I suddenly feel at peace. And you say, well, what happened? And, you know, most people can't say, but the experience of contradiction, it's as though our discriminating mind is arrested or frozen, and we suddenly are sort of knocked back on our heels, and we realize that there's something behind our eyes, so to speak. There's something behind this. It's like there's the movie, but there's something behind the screen, or there's the play on the stage, but, you know, behind the curtains there's something else, and that something else is our big mind. So, you know, once we experience the big mind just a little bit, we don't know what it is, but we feel it, you know, as feeling grounded and safe. And for a while in Zen practice, there's this very powerful sense of a split or a division, right? So if you start practicing seriously, if you really get into Zen, and I so hope you do, you know, you're going to notice that, you know, when you practice, you feel better. And if you forget to meditate, you know, when you go to work, you'll notice a qualitative difference. You know, you don't have the same relaxed responsiveness to things. You know, you're more tense, you're more, you know, reactive. If you start doing meditation, you feel a kind of confidence that you might not even be able to explain, or a kind of you're able to be calm for reasons you can't account for. And if you start coming to Sesshin, which I so recommend, you know, if you haven't come to Sesshin, I really hope you'll give it a try. It's the most wonderful thing in the world, you know. It's absolutely the most amazing thing in the world. And around day three of a Sesshin, people undergo this radical shift, and they may not understand what's happening, but, you know, it's like most of our life is spent in the small mind. It's like 99% of our life is spent in our small conscious minds. And when we start meditating, we spend like 5% of our time with our big mind. And if you meditate regularly, you know, you spend less and less of your total time with your small mind, and more and more with your big mind. And it improves your life in every way. And if you come to Sesshin around day three, it's like, if this makes any sense, it's like the proportion between small mind and big mind shifts. So that it's like most of your consciousness at any particular moment is big mind, and much less of it is small mind. And it feels like heaven. It's like heaven. See, you've actually restored the proper balance between the conscious and the unconscious mind. It's like now they're in the proper balance. So you're thinking much less, but everything around you is so alive, and you feel so safe and connected. It's like now conscious and the big unconscious and the little conscious have come together. Consciousness have come together, see, in the proper balance. This is the unified mind in accord with the way. This is the life of the person of Zen. And people today are almost like monsters. That they really are. I mean, I don't mean they're bad. I mean, we're so deformed by our ignorance of the big mind. You know, we're so unhappy, and we're so compulsive, and so on. Around day three, you have this, it's like the two minds are harmonized, and you feel like you're in heaven. And, you know, then people go home, and, you know, 2 weeks after the Sesshin, they feel that not much has changed. So at first there's this sense of a split between these, the moments where everything is unified, and where you're, you know, unified mind in accord, and your everyday consciousness. But gradually, if you keep practicing Zen, you know, that split disappears, and that the seamless unification of big mind and small mind continues regardless of the circumstances, see. And this is the highest state of awareness, right? When you're, these are totally integrated. And when these are totally integrated, you notice something else, that, you know, big mind is always here. You could say it's between the moments of consciousness. So actually, you know, if you have been meditating for a long time, you realize that conscious awareness is not continuous. This is something you don't have to try to notice. You'll just notice this one day. You know, you're aware, your consciousness is not continuous. It's like interrupted. It's like discontinuous. So we're aware of something, and then we're aware of something else, and then we're aware of something else. And it's like a movie of a still of one of the stills from a film, right? There's a photo, and then there's another photo that's slightly different, and another. When you run that through a projector, it seems to be continuous, but it's not. It's individual shots, right? Well, that's how consciousness works. It's not continuous. So this moment of consciousness, there's this moment of consciousness, you hear the fan overhead, then you feel your leg, and then you feel hot. Maybe you feel it's a little warm in this room. Then you realize you need to take a pee, right? Then you realize your knee hurts, so on and so on. Each moment of consciousness is just like one unified moment of consciousness, and they're not continuous. Between each moment of consciousness, there's an empty space. So it's like little mind, big mind, you know. Your consciousness, your moments of consciousness are like little islands floating on the ocean of your big mind. Yes, that's how it really feels if you meditate for a long time. Your moments of consciousness are like experienced as like little islands floating on the ocean of big mind. That's really the unified mind in accord with the way. And if you meditate long enough, your consciousness, whether you're aware of it or not, will have this unified character all the time. It's like you're sailing on the ocean of big mind all the time, and you go from one little island to the next and enjoy the palm trees or whatever. But that's a totally integrated consciousness, and from the standpoint of Zen, that's our natural state, right? The problem is we've lost touch with that unified consciousness. And that's what, Tangen says to the emperor, but the emperor doesn't get it. You know, after Kokushi dies, Kokushi says, experience reality without any seams, without any interruptions or discontinuities, basically. He's saying, what's it like when big mind and small mind are totally unified? What's that like? And the emperor doesn't know what he's talking about, but he's a good guy. And then he says, okay, well, when I'm dead, Tangen will explain it. And Tangen comes and he says, south of Sho and north of Tan, in between gold abounds. See? So what he's saying is that, you know, between this moment of consciousness and the next moment of consciousness, there is an empty space. And you may not have found it yet, but you feel it as a sense of well-being or groundedness or intimacy. See, it you feel it before you understand it. And the more you sit, the more vast that ocean, that surrounding ocean, becomes for you, right? And then you realize these moments of consciousness are like little islands floating on this great ocean. He says, south of Sho and north of Tan, in other words, between the moments of consciousness, gold abounds. Well, gold, what's that? Well, you know, when you become intimate with your big mind, the character of the big mind changes. You know, initially, you experience the big mind as dark, right? Dark. But, you know, and for many, many years in your practice, when you go into Mushin, Mushin is dark. You can't make this happen, but at some point the character of Mushin changes. And it becomes bright. Bright. The early Buddhist sutras called it bright mind. Bright mind. So, you know, you don't have to think bright mind. You just keep going into the big mind, the unknowable big mind, and its character will change for you. But for a fully awakened person, it's like north of, south of Sho and north of Tan, in between gold abounds. Clear is the river, calm is the sea. See, the Holy One in the Emerald Palace. No Holy One in the Emerald Palace you see. So this is like, this is where we're going with our practice. And every step of it feels better. You know, I promise you that if you just keep going, it's like every step, people don't know why, but it's not that you're in the moment. It's that you're in something deeper than the moment. The moment is in something deeper than the moment, see. Moments come and go, but we're deeply grounded in the ocean of mind, the ocean of being. We are the ocean of mind is our true home, right? That is our true nature, our true home, where we belong. And we become we're like beautiful dolphins who are trapped in a swimming pool, don't even know they're in the water. But at some point we return to the great ocean. And when we return to the great ocean, we feel so alive and so complete. And that's what our practice is all about. Like one step at a time, we're sort of blindly groping, but if you, the ocean becomes more and more vast and beautiful if you just persist. This is Secho's verse. A seamless pagoda, in other words, unified mind in accord with the way, it's difficult to describe. The dragon does not thrive in a placid lake. Tier after tier, superbly it casts its shadow. Let it be admired for a thousand ages.